But I can't think of any better way to begin, and therefore I can't think of anything it would give me more pleasure to say to you than that Professor David Carroll of the New School is here to talk about adventures in social media in the 21st century. To my students who have been forced to watch The Great Hack at least once and are going to have to watch it at least once more if they're going to get out of the course successfully, Mr. Carroll is already an action hero. For those of you who haven't seen The Great Hack or who aren't in my class, it may not be apparent to you that James Bond is in the building. But what will be apparent to you, I hope, by the time that he is done and we are fully launched this morning, is that if users don't have any rights, then they don't have any rights. And the idea of self-government by people, for people, of people, will vanish. And it will feel very convenient and very easy and very much like normal. And Professor Carroll has, in his own American way, making good use of what we have here, which is freedom of thought and the opportunity to move foreign government administrative agencies, proven, I think, those points in a way which even Netflix can't overdramatize. So I offer you David Carroll, an associate professor of media design at Parsons, himself a product of Parsons, of the New School, of that thing that was made by political refugees in the 1930s seeking freedom and the ability to think for themselves, which he now carries on so beautifully. I shouldn't actually have to say anything more than David Carroll, The Great Hack, Alexander Nix, Cambridge Analytica, the future of democracy. Good morning.
Thank you, everyone. It's really great to be here. As you may know, the New School is an idiosyncratic school, and I'm probably an idiosyncratic product of it, because I'm not a lawyer, never studied law, but somehow found myself in the middle of this international intrigue, a story that keeps evolving, and at the minute that I think it's going to die down, it erupts again. So most recently this week, where Jack Dorsey announced that Twitter will be getting out of the business of political ads after the controversy around Zuckerberg and revised policies there. So the title of my talk is Data Quest, Repatriating My Cambridge Analytica Voter Profile, an absurd notion that one would even have to do that. And in all the controversies over how digital technology is used in the political sphere, a common refrain that we heard was what the Trump campaign did in 2016 was no different than what the Obama campaign had done prior. But of course, the Obama campaign was a domestic operation and the Trump campaign was an international one in many different ways. And there is no consensus, especially among the academy, whether Cambridge Analytica had any effect on the election. But that's not my concern. My concern that it was illegal, and that it was illegal under UK law. And so the talk will show you how that came out to be. So just out of curiosity, who here has seen the film, The Great Hack, just so I have a sense of how many of you? Yeah, it's interesting. Usually about half the room has seen it now that I've been going around. So just a few words about the film, the filmmakers. Karim Amer and Jahan Nujaim, their previous film was called The Square, which was really about the Arab Spring and the Egyptian Revolution. And so from their filmography, they have always been curious about the promise and perils of technology and democracy. So of course, the Arab Spring is the first moment where we thought that social media would topple dictators until it did not. And prior to that, Jahan did the film Control Room, which was the story of alternate narratives in the Iraq War. Their film style is verite, and they like to follow people on their journeys. And so The Great Hack follows three primary figures in the scandal: Carol Cadwalader, the reporter from The Observer and Guardian who broke the story and became the story, violating the key rule of journalism, but not her fault. Brittany Kaiser, who was formerly worked on the Obama campaign and then became a lieutenant of Alexander Nix, the CEO of Cambridge Analytica, and cast herself as a whistleblower at the last possible minute. And myself, who the filmmaker started following almost like 2.5 years ago. So that's the story. I'm going to show just a quick clip. Actually, I'll show two clips from the film. So in case you haven't seen it, you get a flavor of what the film is like, and in particular, why it's resonated so well with Netflix audiences. I'll give you one interesting thing about Netflix. Netflix doesn't share its data. The filmmakers don't even know exactly how successful or popular the film is. We have only heard rumors. But one rumor that I heard is that the film broke Netflix's own algorithm. So what Netflix does is it has an algorithm that it uses to predict the audience of content, and the audience shattered the algorithm's prediction within the first 24 hours of the release because it thought that a movie about privacy and politics would not be popular. But I have heard that it is potentially, and I can't verify this, that it's the fifth most watched documentary on Netflix of all time. And we don't know what that means even.
I was teaching digital media and developing apps, so I knew that the data from our online activity wasn't just evaporating. And as I dug deeper, I realized these digital traces of ourselves are being mined into a $1 trillion-a-year industry. We are now the commodity. But we were so in love with the gift of this free connectivity that no one bothered to read the terms and conditions.
So, a couple things. Started out as an entrepreneur. In fact, as part of the NYC Media Lab, which is a consortium of schools, Columbia is one of the founding members. And the tech and media companies and telecom companies of the city, where the members fund academic research to be spun off into commercializations. And indeed, research that I had done with the Media Lab was spun off and funded by Hearst. And it was during that time when I was trying to do a tech startup here that I myself in 2014 had the moment where we connected our app to Facebook. And we realized we could get not only the user's data, but all of their friends as well. And that was as creepy feeling as I'd ever had. And I had no idea that simultaneously at Cambridge University, academics were using the same technique to conduct academic research. And indeed, it was the moment when that research got commercialized and sold to a British military contractor that the scandal began. And it's important to remember that the scandal began in academia, that it started out as our fault. It started out as the pressure to commercialize without appropriate safeguards. And that as an entrepreneur, the pressure to monetize data without thinking about it was something that you could palpably feel. And of course, my startup failed, as most do, and the rest is history from that. The other important thing about the film is that it uses incredible visual effects to communicate an idea that has been difficult to communicate. I certainly struggled to express to general audiences what data exhaust looks like and why it is threatening our very humanity and dignity. And the filmmakers hired two artists to do the visual effects. One artist is Ash Thorpe from Alt Creative, who did the pixel effects that you see here. And another artist was a group from Toronto called Shy Kids, who did all the graphics that overlay social media into actual space to give us a sense of what's happening on people's phones. This was an important aesthetic aspect that is not just, it serves a narrative function. So the next section I'll show is just a showreel from Ash Thorpe from some of the visual effects. What's important is that people are, when they watch the film, they're going inside the algorithm. And they don't even realize that they are going inside the algorithm. And in other sequences, they're going inside the high-speed algorithmic ad tech exchanges, where every time you visit a page, your personal data is broadcast to 100 different companies, all bidding in real time to win the right to show you the ad. People don't even have to realize that that's what they're watching to understand and appreciate the impact of the technology and the industry. When I found myself in the European Union, in Brussels, during their hearing on the Cambridge Analytica scandal, and I'm up on the dais with Christopher Wiley, who was the first whistleblower, Sandy Perikilis, who ran privacy at Facebook after the FTC consent decree and came out at the scandal saying that Facebook wasn't doing anything about privacy. As well as Carol Cadwalader herself and the Information Commissioner of the UK, Elizabeth Denham. What was eerie and coincidental is that it was during the hearing that the deadline expired for the enforcement notice, where the Information Commissioner had ordered the company, Cambridge Analytica, to disclose my full data set. Under Section 7 of the UK Data Protection Act of 1998, it would be a criminal offense to ignore that order. And the deadline expired while it was up there. And so this is the scene when that happened.
Carol tweeted, Prof. Carol also giving evidence to European Parliament today on day of deadline for Cambridge Analytica to turn over his data to him. If it fails to do so, it becomes a matter for criminal proceedings.
Hey, Ravi. Have you heard anything? Not yet. I've been waiting to hear from my lawyer, and we have heard nothing. And so they have not respected the regulator. They are not respecting the law. So now that this is becoming a criminal matter, we are now in uncharted waters. And I will continue to pursue it because their model has the potential to affect a population, even if it's just a tiny slice of the population. Because in the United States, only about 70,000 voters in three states decided the election. So, of course, that comes from the notion that the election was decided in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, and Cambridge Analytica did successfully predict that those would be the battleground states. There's lots of debate whether there was any other effects, but The Electoral College itself has become very hackable because companies are able to assemble super samples of the entire electorate. So every single registered voter can be profiled, and then from there you can model out different algorithmic scenarios. So this is the concern, that this technology is working on a super sample. And I don't think we've confronted yet the risks and threat models that that presents. So the most comprehensive investigations around what happened in 2016 have not occurred in this country. They have occurred in the UK. And two important reports have already been published that document far more than it has come out of our nation's investigations. That would be the Information Commissioner's reports. Another one is still pending. We'll talk about that later. And of course, the parliamentary committee that's been investigating it, the so-called DCMS committee, has investigated this thoroughly. And the overlaps between what happened in 2016, both related to Trump and Brexit. In this report, it describes some of the regulatory actions that they performed against the company, which the real company is called SCL Elections Limited. And they did criminally prosecute the company successfully, which was the only criminal conviction of the company ever in the world, probably, ever will be. So if I had not pursued this, and I had not on July 4th, 2017, filed a complaint with the ICO, essentially stating, why is a British defense contractor interfering in my democracy? There would be no criminal conviction of the company at all. In addition, we just heard that Facebook agreed to pay the £500,000 penalty it was issued. That we just heard that recently. And there's an interesting story there of how the company really effectively got a nice, kind settlement out of that deal, because they admitted no liability at all. And of course, as you know, £500,000 was earned just when I was going over the previous slide. And of course, that's because the UK DPA of 98, that was the maximum penalty. This did not occur while the GDPR was enforceable, so the penalty would be much larger, but not as large as the FTC fine of $5 billion, which of course is a drop in the bucket for the company as well, because the stock increased by $6 billion on the day that was announced, because investors thought that the fine was paltry. The most important sentence in the report has never been reported in the press, and it refers to the problem that the company was actually called SCL Elections, and this sentence here still boggles my mind. It says, had SCL Elections, or Cambridge Analytica, still existed in its original form, our intention would have been to issue the company with a substantial fine for very serious breaches of Principle 1 of the DPA 1998 for unfairly processing people's personal data for political purposes, including purposes connected with the 2016 U.S. presidential campaigns. And then it goes on to say, even though most or all the personal data in question related to US citizens and residents, the processing of this data took place within the UK and was performed by a UK entity, and therefore that's why the UK Information Commissioner had jurisdiction. The translation is that the press was obsessed with Facebook, obsessed with sticking it to Facebook, obsessed with the number 87 million, when the number was much larger. The number was all registered voters. More than 200 million had a file illegally created about them under UK law. And the press never reported it. Just recently, two memoirs have been published by Christopher Wiley, who was the first whistleblower, and then more recently by Brittany Kaiser. They interestingly have very similar subtitles. Christopher Wiley's book is called Mindfuck, Cambridge Analytica and the Plot to Break America. And Brittany Kaiser's book is called Targeted, and it is Cambridge Analytica's whistleblower's inside story of how big data, Trump, and Facebook broke democracy and how it can happen again. Both of these books are worth reading. They corroborate each other's stories in interesting ways, even though they loathe and detest each other. There also are some Rashomon moments where the same thing is depicted from different angles. In particular, one moment I find so interesting is Jeb Bush wanted Cambridge Analytica services but was denied. And each author has different reasons for why Bush campaign was denied the services. But these are important books for skeptics to read. There are lots of people, especially in academia and especially political science, who are adamant that this company had no effect and was snake oil. And I would ask all of those people to read both of these books. Because a lot of those assumptions are based on the understanding of political ads as we conventionally understand them. Ads that look like political ads and say, I approve this message at the end. This company did so much more than that. And it's important to confront all the things that they did or may have done and how difficult it is to even ascertain what they did. And that was part of the struggle for me is deciding I would wait until the Information Commissioner's report came out based on the forensic analysis of the servers seized under criminal warrant before making a judgment as to what they possibly did. Because all other assumptions are based on theoreticals and not the hard empirical data of what was on the servers. But here we have inside stories. Christopher Wiley's story is the origin story of Cambridge Analytica, how it came together. And Brittany Kaiser's story is what happened since and through and in the end. And the sections on the post-mortem of the Trump campaign are particularly disturbing. So what we have learned from this scandal and saga that keeps unraveling is that there is a relationship between data rights and democracy insofar as there is a political technology industry that has emerged, and unfortunately, it is an international industry. And it has been international for quite some time. And also unfortunately, and as strange as it is to say, and as crazy as people think I am to say it, it has been militarized insofar as a military contractor that perfected information warfare techniques out of the post 9/11 hearts and minds in industry got into the business of electioneering around the world, and that same company worked for Trump. And we know that this is international because there are global investigations that have jurisdiction over it. So you can't even dispute that. But there is more than adequate evidence in my mind that there is no firewall between the advertising industrial complex and the military industrial complex and the political technology industry. There's no separation at all. We did not realize we needed to erect that. And we desperately do, still to this day. So what do we do? Well, obviously, what I learned very accidentally, because this was a accidental process that it goes into the film how a researcher based out of Switzerland, Paul Olivier Dehay, who was quite an expert on data protection laws in Europe, the importance of exercising the right of access, which is the right to request your data from a company and their legal obligation to give it to you. And he had been getting his data from tech companies for a while. He got his data from Uber a long time ago, and he had the proof that Uber was improperly tracking users that basically one day Travis Kalanick and Tim Cook butted heads because Uber was, you know, breaking App Store policy to literally make sure that App Store, The people who run the App Store moderation could not access the features that they were moderating. So like using the identifications to cheat the system. So he has been a pioneer in the importance of asking for your data. And so he was looking for a US citizen to do the data request for Cambridge Analytica because he had been following the company for quite some time. And I did that in January 2017, and we'll look at the results of that. But the key thing that I learned is this is the main right that we need to fight for in the United States, because we don't have the right. Because if Cambridge Analytica had been a US company and had not exported our data to a data protecting state, and I had asked them for my data, they would be under no legal obligation to give it to me at all. It was the weird quirk that they exported it that it opened up this loophole to figure out what was going on. So it speaks to the necessity to do this, and fortunately the California Consumer Privacy Act begins to create the right to know in the United States. And there is a bill in Albany called the New York Privacy Act which would do the same and go further. And indeed, this is the fundamental right that we don't have in the US and is the fundamental problem. So this is the key for me. And then the question is, how is that enforceable? Because I still don't have my data, even though the ICO has the servers. But I'll talk about that soon. And that, what is the data? Is it the data that we give to these platforms? Or is it also the data that they infer about us? Mark Zuckerberg, when he talks about privacy, he talks about the visibility of the stuff we put on his platform. And he does not talk about the data that he's generating about us. He thinks that's his data. But in the EU, they say that inferred data is personal data when it is attached to your identity. So this is another battle line that we must fight. Because if we don't have rights to the inferences about us, then we really don't have access. And then the question is, should this data be proactively disclosed to us? We get a bank statement every month. Why don't we get a data statement? And indeed, Senator Feinstein has proposed the Voter Privacy Act, which would require proactive disclosure. That is, campaigns and super PACs would have to let voters know, we have a file on you, click here to validate your identity to see it. So when I did the subject access request in January, I immediately proved the basic hypothesis that our data was in the UK. What was obvious about that is because they asked me for my photo ID and bank statements and utility bills to verify my identity. And then I had to pay in £10 and send it to SEL Elections Limited. So we proved Cambridge Analytica was a thin facade. The SEL Elections Limited was the registered data controller. And we first saw that, wow, what is the price to buy back your personal data? Well, under the UK DPA, it was a £10 fee. The GDPR eliminates data request fees. So the question is, what is personal data worth? Well, it started out, my data was worth £10, but it ballooned to a much larger amount later on. Then on the 27th of March in 2017, I received a letter from Cambridge Analytica, and they described how they were trying to be compliant with the UK DPA, and some very vague descriptions about what the data was about and how it was used. But what I found most remarkable was who signed the letter, a person named Julian Wheatland, who was the group COO. He wasn't even a director of Cambridge Analytica. He was signing for and on behalf of Cambridge Analytica. And I love this line here. Some names and identifying particulars are not being disclosed to protect the identity of third parties. So clients of Cambridge Analytica and partners get privacy, but voters do not. And there is the pure asymmetry of power that really is crystallizing the problem. Because one of the things that we demanded to know is, where did you get the data? What did you do with it? And who did you share it with? And those are all legitimate questions under the DPA Section 7, and the questions they refused to answer, and the basis of the lawsuit, and the basis of the complaint, and part of the reason why they were criminally convicted of not answering those questions. Willing to be criminals
instead of answering the questions. So the Excel spreadsheet that I got in March contained my voter registration. You would expect that. Some people are surprised to realize that voter files are public. In some states, they're just downloadable from the Secretary of State website, like Ohio, believe it or not. Insanity. The New York voter files were available on a website for a short period of time before people said, please take them down from the website. So this shouldn't be that much of a surprise. And there was also a tab about the elections I had participated in and some of the results of those, which is not a surprise. That's public. You can just cross-reference that. So nothing surprising here. Then there was a tab called Models, which had 10 political topics ranked in order of importance and propensities. You can see who their client was here. Very unlikely Republican was what I was ranked at, but that's easy to do since I was registered as a Democrat. But what was really curious is this ranking. Can anybody see something really peculiar about the ranking? Assuming that number one is the most important and number 10 is the least important, but we're not even sure about that. Anything really weird stick out based on that ranking? Number three, gun rights, number three. Wow. I did not know that I cared about guns that much, especially since it's like above education and I am a teacher. And hilariously, number six is socially progressive civil rights, and I end up being like a rights guy. So it made no sense, very peculiar. And when we had experts look at this, they said, well, it's either not real, it's just made up, or it is being, there's more data that's deriving this, but you could not derive this ranking just from the demographics alone. There has to be more data behind this, if this is real. But we're not even sure it's real, because we can't validate it. And it's probably just fake. It's probably just a spreadsheet they put together to get me to shut up and go away.
Well, about.
So I'm going to show you now a clip from the committee in the UK talking about my case. One of the strange things about this is like you get mentioned in Parliament, so you have to like wake up at 5 in the morning to see the 10 a.m. Hearings. And this is Damian Collins, the chair of the committee, asking the information commissioners about the status of my case, and particularly since the company has gone insolvent. And will I ever get my data?
As well about Professor David Carroll's case against Cambridge Analytica, which I know you'll be aware of. He's been unsuccessful in his appeal. I mean, what grounds are there when someone has made a data request to a data holder? That request would appear to be lawful, but that company's gone into administration. What should be the mechanism for retrieving data in a situation like that?
Yes, I mean, as far as it's possible, it depends on where that data has gone to and where it resides and how those residual assets of the administration are dealt with. As data becomes more and more valuable, that is probably something the insolvency law is going to have to be looking at in terms of the other assets of an organisation. In respect of his individual case, we've obviously prosecuted the company successfully and have achieved a fine through the courts. We continue to analyse the information that we hold from the company, one of the purposes of which is, as far as is possible, if we are able to identify, if not his specific data, but at least be able to provide that piece which the company wasn't able to provide with him, which is the narrative as to how the data was used and how it moved through the sequence of algorithms within Cambridge Analytica. We hope to be able to produce that in due course.
So relating to David Carroll's...
Well, maybe if we can do it at an individual level, that would be great. But at least in terms of being able to describe the process in more detail in terms of how the data moved through the various stages.
So you believe you'll be able to...
We have people working at it. I wouldn't want to put words in their mouth as to how accurate they'll be. It's a complicated task. We've got large sets of data, some of which is combined US electoral data, but also some of the ocean data examples that others have given evidence on. It's more likely we'll be able to tell the narrative rather than pinpoint an individual's journey through that process. But that's certainly something we haven't given up on, yeah, and we continue to pursue.
Yeah.
So this is from April of this year. And I'm happy to say that the ICO has successfully isolated my data in the data set. I haven't received it yet, but I do expect to. And in addition, my taking the lawsuit all the way into insolvency court was an important step because we helped to pressure the administrators to release 4 passwords of 4 servers that the ICO was unable to get into. The ICO processed many, 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 many terabytes of data. And so what they're describing here is how the data sets were combined through various stages of algorithms. And when they mentioned ocean data, that would be the psychographic data, ocean standing for openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism. And the basic model of their attempt is that they took the super sample of all the voters and they looked for people who are outliers, meaning extremely way above average on particular rankings, especially neuroticism, because those people could be then micro-targeted and they tended to have a click-through rate 20 to 30% higher than normal, which would show their receptivity, and then they could be continually tested with further messages and narrow-targeted and retargeted around everywhere they went on the web. And that's one of the sort of concerns, that we don't understand how the model worked and we don't understand singling out voters in this very precise way, because most people don't understand that you can upload voter files into Facebook and target people as individuals. So the problem is we have created a sortable, addressable electorate, and that algorithmic democracy rules the day. And that's the problem, is that the tools to sell skin creams and ski vacations are being used to select voters and to create narrow-casted narratives, and they do not know they've been singled out, and they do not know how their characteristics are being determined to message them. And they do not know that they are being continually tested on, and the performance of these messages are in an algorithmic machine. So this is why the right of access, the right to know, is the only tool we have to counter this effect. And we don't have this right in the United States. We only know this because an international defense contractor worked in the 2016 election. So here is the problem, is that advertisers get all the privacy and we get none. And we know this because of how easy it is to run untraceable, untrackable, unattributable influence campaigns and to micro-target them on individual voters. And individual voters have no idea this is happening, and it becomes extremely difficult to find out who's behind it. And this ultimately, I think, is why Jack Dorsey threw in the towel on political ads, because it's more trouble than it's worth. And there's no way to make things sufficiently traceable and transparent. Even though Facebook assures us that their transparency tools are adequate, but the problem is Facebook does not expose custom audiences, which is the feature that allows you to upload data into Facebook and to target individuals, not segmentations and demographics. And indeed, the letter of Facebook employees making specific suggestions to leadership that was published in the New York Times, those employees specifically referenced custom audiences as a threat to the political process. We have heard nothing from Facebook leadership about that particular feature. But that, I think, is the critical problem. So as we debate what we need to do in the United States, and unfortunately it's going to be a messy problem of federalism, because state laws will come first and Washington will have to catch up and preempt, and what will be the grand bargain for preemption? And so this is a stack of basic rights that I seem to think we need based on my adventure here. And it goes from the bottom up, not the top down. The bottom, the most foundational one, is the right of knowledge, the right to know about your data, wherever it may be, and how enforceable that can be, and how much disclosure is based upon that. And does it include inferences about us? And does it include algorithmic interpretability or not? And once you can achieve knowledge, do you get a statement? And is it annual, semi-annual, et cetera? All these things can be worked out. But the fundamental need is not knowledge. Then we would need control. We would need to be able to exert control based on that knowledge. And if we discovered that there were situations in which we objected to the use of our data, we should have a right to object to that. And this comes to moving us more towards opt-in than opt-out, because Europe has moved in this direction. And in a sense, Jack Dorsey moved Twitter in this direction, because he said, political messaging will be opt-in now. If you want a politician or a organization, you follow them. They're not going to buy your attention anymore. That's moving towards opt-in in a very deliberate way. But the thing that really troubled me in this whole experience is the necessity to establish what I guess we would call a data creditorship. Because what happened in the end in insolvency court was that we argued that the administrators showed a bias against me as a contingent creditor because I had an outstanding claim. And although the judge agreed that bias was shown against me, it did not meet the level required to rule the remedy, which would have been to move the company into state receivership, basically, and fire the administrators. We had KPMG in the wings, willing to take over the administration and deal with the rights issues, because the administrator that was appointed by the court refused to deal with the outstanding data rights issues. And I think the judge did not want to create the precedent of a data creditor, because he specifically said, this is my court is not the place for this to be figured out. I think he was really annoyed that an American was in his court. I think he was really annoyed that everything was politicized, not appreciating that there's no way that political technology cannot be politicized. It is a partisanship machine. Its sole purpose is to identify, manipulate, and amplify partisanship. It has no other purpose. And so if data is worth something, then why wouldn't a data subject have creditor rights in bankruptcy insolvency? That's why in the clip to Parliament, the information commissioner, the deputy information commissioner, said that insolvency law has to deal with this. And indeed, Cambridge Analytica LLC was abandoned in bankruptcy court here in New York, and the FTC is unable to prosecute the company like it would like to. And Steve Bannon, they are having trouble serving him with his subpoena. And the reality is there's a company called Cambridge Analytica Holdings LLC, which actually owns the shell companies all the way through, and nobody knows about it. And we only discovered this because of taking them to court in the UK. So ultimately, business law, business transparency is the main problem. It's the ultimate loophole. Today, if you wanted to commit mass data abuse, create a company, do the abuse, get caught, go out of business. Nothing will stop you. Thank you.
So I suspect other people may have questions. I have only two. You're not thinking of giving up that smartphone, are you? In other words, we have to make a system in which guys like you can walk around carrying stuff like that and still you'll be okay. Maybe that isn't going to happen just because we make some laws. In a room full of lawyers, you didn't really think that they were going to believe you if you told them we just need to pass a law and fix some bankruptcy rules and everything will be right? What is the end game of this from your point of view, David? Where, when we are living in a decent society again that protects democracy, what will it be like? Is it just going to be a couple of statutory fixes and we're home free?
No, I think, you know, fixing some laws will create some market conditions, and it's probably the interplay between the two that will move the needle. The ad tech industry must be semi-destroyed, and the tech titans must be neutered, and international cooperation must be achieved to sort of begin the process.
And what are you telling your kids about what they ought to do?
You know, my daughter is actually represented in the film. The filmmakers negotiated to put her in the film. We didn't want her, but so there's like a scene where I pick her up from school and her face is carefully concealed. And, you know, she understands who her father is now, and that's how she deals with, you know, not having the same things that her peers have. But she understands because of that. But I struggle to communicate to other parents, like, why it matters, especially at this age where these things are happening. But the way I sort of use it is that, thanks to the COPPA law, we can say to her, you have to be 13 before you get your own accounts, just like you have to be 16 to get a driver's license and 18 to vote and 21 to drink, that legal structures have created milestones of growing up, and that's sort of the best tool I have as a parent.
But they're still inferring the hell out of her, aren't they?
They really are.
Yeah. Anybody have any questions?
So you said Twitter, there's a distinction between a political ad and these other things you were talking about that clearly have a political impact but don't mention a party. Because you're making me think differently. How are they going to identify what's once we have something about politics? How are they going to deal with things that really are political but aren't on their face?
Sure. So Twitter has already established. They basically, if you go to twitter.com/transparency or something like that, you can see that they have a list of certified political campaigns and certified political issues, because they already have some transparency available. So like, if you see a campaign ad, it's labeled accordingly. If you see an issue ad, it's labeled accordingly. You can go into it, you can see the spend, the target, when it ran, who's behind it. So there's already some transparency that they've already made some sense of certifications. And it's pretty comprehensive. So they're not starting from zero. And you have to draw the line somewhere. And drawing the line somewhere is better than nowhere, in my opinion. But this is the notion, and this only relates to what is a promoted ad. Obviously, nothing restricts you from making your own choices and following and seeing the retweets of others and so on, and the search and recommendation. So it's no way censorship. It's just paid positioning.
I guess I'm curious about your thoughts on the limits of imposing these controls through ads, because, you know, are you going to change that people are getting their news off of Facebook? I don't think you are. Are you going to change that inferences are being made? I don't think you are. Do you think that people, that the population writ large, are sufficiently invested in this that they would turn off inferences? I don't think you will. So I think if Facebook and Twitter said no more political ads tomorrow, the self-selection problem, as combined with the sophistication by political operators in getting this information out there, suggests to me that giving people disclosure and rights in respect of this data will not be sufficient to stop it from being abused.
So I was asked to give evidence to Canadian Parliament, because they also have been investigating this, because there's a whole Canadian side to the scandal, meaning a Canadian affiliate that did Brexit and did the unlawful stuff with Brexit. And when we talked about it there, the chair was a conservative and the deputy chair was a liberal, and the chair said, you know, if we have disclosure in Canada, it's going to change the way we campaign. Because the conservative said, I look for my voters using gun rights as a proxy, and the liberal said, I use animal rights to find my voters. And they said, if my voters knew that's how I was finding them, I would change my strategy. So it is not so much about, you know, everyone exerting their rights. It only takes a couple people to exert the rights. It's mostly about deterring bad actors, or it's mostly about shifting strategies, which are using techniques that people are not aware of. And so I'm not saying this is a silver bullet. I never claim that it is. I'm saying it's like stopping the momentum, slowing down the unbridled, unregulated, no protections at all. Because right now we have zero. I would like us to have at least some.
Right to make you the skeptic on the afternoon panel, Jim. We're going to have a bunch of fun time. One last question, please.
Yeah.
Turn the microphone on, if you wouldn't mind.
Is it on?
Yep.
Okay. So what about the relationship between the government, meaning the National Security Agency, the FBI, the NSA, CIA, buying data from Facebook, Google, Amazon. So the government has a vested interest in maintaining the status quo of these data criminals. So it's their sort of co-conspirators in this operation. So what are your thoughts?
So if we think that Edward Snowden is the whistleblower of government surveillance, then perhaps Wiley and Kaiser are the whistleblowers of commercial surveillance. And in particular, the overlap, there are sections in Wiley's book where he talks about Palantir and Cambridge Analytica collaborating way closer than has been reported in the press. And one of the interesting things that Palantir was interested in is how Cambridge Analytica could feed them data that they could not achieve through their own contracts, and et cetera. So, on one hand, yes, you're right, in terms of there's the tremendous overlap there that we have to confront. And but interestingly, SCL worked for the CIA, the State Department, GCHQ, NATO. The sort of privatization of the government on the other side is the same problem. So, you know, we just have to realize that there are no firewalls. I mean, that's part of my point, is that we have no firewalls. We never even bothered to create them. So what do we do about it?
Yeah, what do we do about it? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
After a breath of fresh air, we should do something geeky. So give us 1 second to set the stage, and we'll go to software and licensing.